This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Theodore Roosevelt, the 26th President of the United States, played many roles during his years in public life: trustbuster, rough rider, bully pulpit practitioner, big game hunter. But he is perhaps less well known to the public as an ardent naturalist and conservationist who spent a lifetime outdoors recording the natural history around him for the benefit of science and future generations of Americans. In a new book, The Naturalist, Theodore Roosevelt, A Lifetime of Exploration and the Triumph of American Natural Science, author and Smithsonian mammalogist Darren Lundy explores this side of Roosevelt's life. Lundy argues that by seeing Teddy Roosevelt as a hunter-naturalist, we can gain a richer understanding of the president behind the famous spectacles and his contributions to natural science and public life. Today on The Exchange, it's Theodore Roosevelt, the naturalist. Let's hear from you. You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. And joining me for the show from Washington, D.C. is Darren Lundy. Darren is a supervisory museum specialist in the Division of Mammals at the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History. His new book is The Naturalist, Theodore Roosevelt, A Lifetime of Exploration and the Triumph of American Natural History. And Darren, welcome to The Exchange.
Thanks for having me, Dean.
There's a lot to talk about here on Teddy Roosevelt, but let's start with a little bit of your own background. I'm interested to learn how you came up with the idea of writing this book and how Roosevelt's life as a naturalist intersects with your own work as a mammalogist.
Yeah, I got interested in Roosevelt when I, by accident, discovered that he had gotten interested in natural history at a very early age. He was only 6 or 7, and he got interested in natural history through taxidermy. He grew up in New York City, like myself, and had very little contact with nature until a happen chance encounter on the streets with a dead seal that was laid out on Broadway. It was something that was put out in front of a shop to attract customers, but he was fascinated by it. And that was the beginning of what he described as his career, his lifelong career as a naturalist. And it's a career that took its course through taxidermy, through his building museums in his room as a boy, and from there it just went on all the way through the rest of his life.
And so that's what got you initially interested. How does it intersect so with your own work at the Smithsonian still today? Do you come across specimens that he's donated? Are there exhibits that talk about his contribution?
I guess what I should say, what I didn't say there, is that I got my start in much the same way, wandering around New York and finding specimens, things dead on the road, and teaching myself taxidermy. And just I could really relate to Roosevelt's introduction to natural history as a young boy, because I could relate to what it's like not being around nature, not having access to animals in wilderness, and anything that I found on the streets, what little encounters that I had, they were wonderful experiences. The objects that I found were like treasures that I naturally wanted to preserve, and just naturally taught myself taxidermy and built my own natural history museum. And that is what, got me on my career path. And so, went to college and worked at the University Natural History Museum, and at some point realized, hey, I can make a career out of this. And I spent 20 years at the American Museum of Natural History in New York City, and now I've been 6 years at the Smithsonian studying mammals, taking care of their collections of mammals at these institutions. But when I realized that Roosevelt had that very same experience, that same visceral early on in his life, that sort of just stumbling along the streets of New York and discovering something that that hooked you on nature. And it's not, you know, it wasn't this beautiful outdoor experience. It was a dead seal on Broadway.
Yeah, it's interesting to me that, you know, you are describing something very similar to what you write about Teddy Roosevelt. You know, as a young person, you may see a dead animal and you either say, wow, that's interesting, or, ooh, that's a dead animal.
Right.
It sounds like both you and Roosevelt were kind of captivated by it. So you talk in the book about Roosevelt's parents kind of tolerating this and giving him a space up high up in their home to have his own little museum. Did you do something similar with your taxidermy and collection?
Absolutely. You have to have great parents that let you do these things in the first place. But yeah, I set up a little taxidermy shop in the garage, and
wow.
You know, I mean, I was in the single digits, you know, I was 9 or 10 or something, and had a real taxidermy shop that, you know, eventually I got books and I studied it, but a lot of it is very intuitive. But I got really serious. Yeah, I mean, it's something that, you know, it's an art, but for me, the interest was I wanted to learn how to preserve specimens because I wanted to keep these objects as kind of my link to nature, my link to natural history. And that's how I got interested in natural history museums. I mean, we can't always walk out our back door, or at least I felt I couldn't always have access to nature. And
right.
For me, preserving it in museums was just a way of keeping this stuff close. And Roosevelt was the same way, and that's how he got started as a naturalist.
We're talking with Darren Lundy today. He's a museum specialist at the Smithsonian and author of a new book on Theodore Roosevelt, the Naturalist. And you can join the conversation at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send us emails, exchange@nhpr.org. So let's shift into the present day for your career. You talk a bit about in the book of some of your own adventures. Before we get into talking about Roosevelt's adventures, some of your own adventures, it had almost a kind of for me, and sort of an Indiana Jones feel to it. You've traveled all over the world, pretty remote areas. Tell us a little bit about some of your more interesting adventures.
Yeah, I mean, that Indiana Jones aspect of it's real, it's there. These are museum expeditions. The purpose of them is to get out into very remote areas where the biodiversity hasn't been explored, where there are things that haven't been documented or discovered, even new species sometimes. And so these expeditions will go out, you know, and I've worked all over South America and Central Africa, Southeast Asia, usually just trying to get into those last places on the map where there just haven't been explorations, and getting in and collecting specimens so that we could bring them back to museums and study them more carefully and compare them to specimens, in some cases specimens collected by, you know, Roosevelt himself or people from his era. I mean, museums, you go to a natural history museum and you'll see specimens on exhibit, and that's part of what a natural history museum does. There's another side, which is behind the scenes,
right,
which is vast collections of specimens that are used by scientists. And that's what Roosevelt was interested in.
Well, and you discuss, in fact, that it sounds like a lot of these vast areas in the back rooms of our great museums is really kind of where the real scientific work takes place.
That's right.
Go ahead.
I mean, no, they're scientific laboratories. I mean, they're places where they're not storerooms. They're places where scientists go and they examine the specimens that are kept there in a very interactive way.
So what we're seeing in the actual museum exhibits, that's a fraction of the overall collections, or what would you say?
Well, I think a better way to put it is what you see in a museum is what is what should be out there to present the public message. I mean, there's a public side to the museum that has one mission, which is, you know, overall general education about natural history. And then there's a scientific side, which is a lot of those exhibits are based on the science that's going on in a museum. So, you know, it's often said that, you know, less than 1% of what is in a museum is exhibited. Mm-hmm. And that is true. Far less than 1% is on exhibit. And then the natural sort of retort to that is, well, why don't you put it all on exhibit? Well, it would be overwhelming. But also, that's not the purpose of a lot of these specimens. I mean, there's science that goes on, and then the results of that science are presented.
Yeah, you describe in the book that they're basically building these museum buildings as quickly as they could and filling them up a year at a time. It's just remarkable, the volume of collecting that went on. We're going to talk a little bit about Teddy Roosevelt, how hunting fit into his worldview, but I'm interested to hear how it fits into yours. I assume you do trapping to get some of these specimens, but what about hunting?
Well, I've always, like Roosevelt, I've always been interested in the hunting side of it and the sort of the adventure side of natural history. I mean, Roosevelt famously didn't want to be a bookish, armchair-style naturalist. He wanted to be the kind of naturalist that got out and had adventures, and hunting was a surrogate for that. He wasn't always a hunter. He was a naturalist first, and he discovered hunting as an adolescent, and it kind of, there's a... at least at that time, there was a very strong connection between hunting and the collecting of specimens. They used some of the same techniques. I mean, when we go on these expeditions, we're not necessarily going out with guns. Sometimes we do, but we're camping. It's very outdoorsy. It's very, very much, it's very close to, you know, a lot of recreational things that people do. Of course, we're out there for work, and it's hard and it's difficult work. But yeah, me, you know, I'm interested in that side too, and that's part of the attraction.
Mm-hmm. One final question for you. Tell us a little bit about your children's book writing. I thought that was very interesting that you've also written, I think, one or more children's books. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think I'm up to I have another one coming out that'll bring me up to 10.
Wow.
And so about every other year I have one. They're all on mammals, which is my specialization, and on natural history, and they're for beginning readers. And I started writing children's books because I was a little, I guess, disappointed that there wasn't a lot of good nonfiction out there about animals that really spoke to children honestly and that presented them with the facts in an accurate and honest way. And so most of my books kind of, you know, talk about mammals that are not well known, you know, no lions, tigers, polar bears, elephants. No, I talk about meerkats and bats and, you know, different kinds of monkeys that you never hear about. So, yeah, I enjoy that. It's something that I really enjoy is speaking to, you know, all different ages, and just using my expertise and trying to communicate what I love.
I want to ask you a little bit more about taxidermy. It's something that has always mm-hmm. fascinated me. I don't know that I would necessarily want to learn how to do it, but I've you know, seen a lot of these, all of the sort of major museums that you have mentioned. We mm-hmm. also have up here in St. Johnsbury, Vermont, you may be familiar with the Fairbanks Museum, which was the private collection of an industrialist, Franklin Fairbanks, and it's something something like 75,000 Victorian specimens from his personal collection. So my question is that what I think we typically think of taxidermy as kind of an old technique, a Victorian technique. Sounds like it's still an integral part of what you do. But how has it changed and or not changed since Roosevelt's time 100, 120 years ago?
Well, I think I should start out by saying that I've done a lot of taxidermy, but I am not a taxidermist, I never have been. But it's something that is not nearly as hard as you might imagine. I think, it's integral to what we do. It's part of preserving specimens. It's constantly changing. It's changing even today. It's becoming much more like sculpture. Mm-hmm. Most of the taxidermists that I know consider themselves artists. I think it's an underappreciated art. I think in our scientific collections, we're not doing art. We're using some of the same basic principles to preserve specimens that maybe we're borrowing some of the same techniques, but we're not necessarily trying to create an art exhibit in a scientific collection.
Yeah, you talk in the book about the sort of the transformation from taxidermy as kind of skinning and stuffing animals to preserve their structure to essentially putting skins over sculptures. You have that picture in the book of that elephant sculpture being created for one of the skins from the African expedition. So that was just interesting to see how the concept changes as technology advances.
Right.
Let's start talking about Teddy Roosevelt himself and spend a little bit of time talking about his sort of how his childhood was formative. You've mentioned the SEAL episode and, you know, living in New York and not being near nature. But talk a little bit about his health issues and how that seemed to actually lead him to a life of sort of vigorous outdoor activity.
Yeah, he was very sickly, most famously, you know, having asthma, but he had a lot of other health issues as well, you know, just sort of these nondescript headaches and, you know, constant ailments. And his family dealt with it by thinking he just needed to get out. He needed to get out into the country. He needed to be more vigorous. There was this thought that, you know, with rapid urbanization, there was this feeling that the city was what made you sick, you know, and it's the bad air and not being able to be vigorous and get outdoors and do vigorous things. And his father was a muscular Christian. He applied...
That's an interesting idea.
And he, you know, he felt that, you know... He felt very strongly that physical fitness was something that was very closely linked to morals, that if you wanted to be a moral person, you also had to be a physically fit person. And so he spent a great deal of time, probably not enough. I mean, they got him out into the country whenever he had these episodes, you know, and then as soon as he was better, he'd be back in the city again. But Roosevelt would get out specifically for that purpose, and his father, you know, took him up to the Adirondacks in northern New York on camping trips. And, you know, gradually it did make him a little more robust. He always suffered from asthma. I think he just got better at hiding it as he got older.
Mm-hmm. And he had a weak heart as well, we read.
He had a weak heart and took heart medication throughout his life. And, you know, famously he was told before he got married that... he had to lead a sedentary life, that he couldn't even race up a flight of stairs, that he had to, you know, sit at a table and, you know, do something very sedentary. And he just recoiled at that and just said, if I have to live this kind of life, I don't care how long I live, I'm just going to do what I have to do. And, you know, decided to live a life of adventure.
It's interesting. Your book seems to suggest that because he knew about this issue with his heart, it almost kind of added a little bit to his risk-accepting nature when it came to expeditions and hunting, because he knew he could kind of go at any moment.
He was a risk-taker. There's no doubt about that. And he felt that he just had to live life to the fullest while he was alive and that he could drop dead at any moment.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the, you mentioned a number of kind of formative relationships that he has in his teens and 20s that really kind of show him the way to a life focused on naturalism. Just maybe highlight a couple of kind of the key people that enter his life, you know, fairly early on.
Well, you'd have to start with his father, of course. I mean, he didn't enter his life. He was always there.
Right.
But his father was a great influence on Roosevelt. And unlike a lot of parents back then, he was very much engaged with his son. He was very providing advice and really, really teaching him on what he needed to be. And when he lost his father, he went through various... surrogates, mm-hmm. You know, his father died, and it was devastating for Roosevelt. And as he, you know, went west, his guides and he went up to Maine while his father was still alive, and shortly after his father died, he started taking trips up to Maine. You know, Wilmot Sewall Wilmot Dowell and his guides in Maine were like a first surrogate father, and then his. When they followed him out west. But I think one of the more important of his later influences was George Bird Grinnell, who was a museum naturalist and a scientist, and he really opened Roosevelt's eyes to natural history.
We need to take a short break here, but we have much more on Theodore Roosevelt's legacy as a hunter-naturalist in a moment. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Today on The Exchange, Theodore Roosevelt's legacy as a hunter-naturalist. We want you to call in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. I have a guest with me today. Joining me from Washington, D.C. is Darren Lundy. He's supervisory museum specialist at the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History, and he's author of a new book on Theodore Roosevelt, The Naturalist. And again, you can join us at 1-800-892-6477. You can email us, exchange@nhpr.org. And Darren, right before the break, we were talking about some of Roosevelt's formative relationships, and you had mentioned Grinnell.
Yeah, George Bird Grinnell was 10 years older than Roosevelt and was a real icon of the American West. He was really everywhere when things were happening in that pivotal period. I mean, he was there on some of the earliest explorations of Yellowstone. He was with Custer, you know, before his last stand, and he was at the Yale Peabody Museum, and he was a paleontologist and museum naturalist. And Roosevelt's introduction to him is when Roosevelt 10 years later started going out west himself. And his eyes were just wide open. He thought it was the most wonderful thing that there were animals and game everywhere, and here's this wonderful, pristine environment in Roosevelt's eyes, and wrote his first book about that, Hunting Trips of a Ranchman. And it was reviewed by George Bird Grinnell, who said, well, this is a great book. You know, it's a fresh young author, and, you know, he's got a few misconceptions, but Roosevelt was livid, you know, that Grinnell would even say anything to suggest that he was naive or didn't really understand the West, and he stormed into Grinnell's office in New York and demanded an explanation. And that's when Grinnell really started to explain to him that it's like, look, you know, kid, I was there, you know, when the West was really wild, and he's like, you have no idea what it was like. And it brings up an important point because, you know, our baselines are constantly shifting, and when Roosevelt first went west, he thought it was this pristine wilderness. I mean, he knew people had been there. The railroads had just come through. But it was Grinnell that really opened his eyes, and significantly, Grinnell was a paleontologist, so he had studied, you know, fossil species that had gone extinct, you know, fairly recently, and he had a great sense of the concept of extinction and how, and also a good personal sense of how the West was changing, and really kind of set Roosevelt straight on the fact that, you know, things really can go extinct and we really could lose this precious resource.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me. I mean, Roosevelt just, particularly the young Roosevelt, just seemed, you know, kind of tremendously curious and industrious and kind of figuring out who to model himself after and literally, as you mentioned, kind of almost sort of milking these individuals for information on, you know, the West or hunting or naturalism, et cetera. Could you say a little bit? I found it interesting in the book that Roosevelt starts out kind of almost exclusively with a focus on birds, sort of ornithology, and then sort of shifts his interest to mammals and then to the big game mammals. What do you think? Why do you think that was the case, rather than just sort of sticking with birds his whole life?
Yeah. He got interested in birds because they were accessible. Even in New York City or at Oyster Bay, or, you know, he could see the birds. They were out during the day. It didn't take that much effort. He was also very nearsighted. He had very poor vision. You know, and the birds were just something that he, you know, early on was able to, that was what he was exposed to. You know, mammals, you have to, they're most of them are out at night. They're a little more cryptic. You kind of have to hunt them down. You know, literally or figuratively. But I think he made the switch from, of course, he was always interested in birds throughout his life and remained an avid birder, but made the shift to mammals in large part because of hunting and because of his need for manly adventure. Yeah.
There seems almost kind of a sort of proving yourself aspect to this, you know, the sort of the hunt and the sort of the larger and more dangerous the animal, the more kind of he's viewed it more as sort of a test of his manhood. It's very interesting to see that transformation. Slightly different subject, then we'll get back to talking about a little bit more history. We had a email from Matthew and Henniker, and Matthew says, among other things, all this collecting is only evidence that man has essentially commodified nature future, perhaps ultimately to his undoing? And I just this is sort of an obvious question, and I imagine it's something you hear from other people, given the reaction we see nowadays to let's remember, for example, the dentist who took the big lion in Africa either last year or earlier this year, and the mm-hmm. shooting of the silverback gorilla at the zoo. And so I understand it's a different time now than it was 100 years ago. But I have to confess, I sometimes found it difficult to look at the pictures in the book of, you know, Roosevelt and his son Kermit, you know, posing with some magnificent dead animal in Africa. And even some of his descriptions of the hunt mm-hmm. were difficult for me to read. I think and you mentioned that he referred to people who criticized him for hunting as mushy sentimentalists or being soft in the head. So talk a little bit about
those
that.
Were Roosevelt's words.
Absolutely.
Those are the words Roosevelt used.
Yeah, his exact words. So talk a little bit about sort of that ethos and then kind of what it's like now by comparison. I think that's our emailer is getting at in his email.
I specifically, you know, I struggled with, am I going to include some of these hunting trophy pictures in the book? And am I going to include these descriptions of the hunts? And ultimately, I decided I had to include them for several reasons. But I think the most important reason is that in his time, Roosevelt himself specifically didn't shy away from including those details in his books. And the reason why he didn't shy from that is he was very conscious of the fact that he was living in a time that was a moment in time that was going to disappear forever. You know, he saved land. He, you know, set aside reserves, you know, and he's remembered for his conservation achievements. But at the same time, I think he also wanted to preserve something of the memory of what life was like when there were these, you know, great herds of game roaming across Africa. He missed it in the American West. You know, he went out there looking for bison, and they had already been devastated. And you know, eventually did get his bison. You know, one of the last. And then Grinnell changed his ethic and said, "Look, you really can't be doing this kind of stuff." Mm-hmm. You know, the way we've been doing it in the past. And throughout his life, Roosevelt, I think he struggled with this too, and I think he specifically didn't want to shy away from saying it like it was because he wanted to record what it was like. He knew we wouldn't be doing this for very much longer, that it was, you know, with population growth and the rise of civilization, it just wasn't going to be sustainable on that scale.
Go ahead.
How does that relate to today? I mean, you know, obviously we're not doing anything on that scale. I mean, you mentioned the lion hunting dentist. I mean, that's not scientific collecting. That's not has nothing to do with anything that I do. That's something entirely different. That's you know, illegal poaching.
Yeah, I was just sort of thinking, imagining you describe in the we're going to go to the phones in a moment, but we describe the African expedition that he and his son Kermit took something like over 500 large mammals over the course of a year, and I'm trying to imagine like a president going and doing that now. It's just not even in the realm of possibility.
No, it's not, and nor should anyone attempt to do that. I mean, you know, I mean, in that time, you have to remember that on his expedition, he had a very large contingent of porters and local helpers, and he had scientists with him, and he had to feed them. And the way you feed people on an expedition like that at that time is to feed them meat. And so a lot of those animals were, but it comes to about one or two large animals a day, which he felt was sustainable, and all of those specimens were those animals were preserved as specimens, which are still used today.
Yeah, you talk in the book about him showing up at the safari, and there's 265 people waiting for him to kick it off. Let's go to the phones, and we have Steve mm-hmm. calling from Albany, New York. Steve, welcome to the Exchange.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
I've just started the book, and it's really good. But what I really wanted to ask was, when did Roosevelt really make his shift to Africa? What was the trigger?
Sure.
Darren? Well, his shift to Africa. It's an interesting point. He was a diehard American, and when he was in the White House, he knew, you know, several years before he was going to leave the White House, he knew that he wanted to do a big trip. In fact, you know, his whole life he had been dreaming of doing one of these grand expeditions where he could get out and be the intrepid naturalist. And he was toying with the idea of going to Alaska, but he had, you know, a regular correspondence with the big game hunters of Europe that were mostly focused in Africa. And he just decided that it was in a White House luncheon where he had a number of guests, and some of them were men from Alaska and others were for, you know, more African-focused, and they were all exchanging stories and kind of competing with each other, trying to get the president to decide. And it was at that luncheon that he decided he wanted to go. He was going to go to Africa. He was going to live his... It's important to note that when he was just a tiny little boy, maybe 6 or 7 years old, he was captivated with books about Africa. You know, Livingstone's Missionary Travels in South Africa was one of his favorite books. So this is something that was deep-rooted in him. And he finally just sort of pulled the trigger, so to speak, and decided to do it.
Steve, thanks for that call. We're talking with Darren Lundy today. He's author of a new book on Theodore Roosevelt, The Naturalist, and he's also a museum specialist at the Smithsonian Museum of Natural History. And Darren, let's go back to talking a little bit about the late 19th century. I was really fascinated to read about the impact of the railroads and kind of the ways in which it just fundamentally transformed and shaped Roosevelt's notion of conservation. You talk about Yellowstone. You talk about armies of naturalists going out with the railroads and actually with the U.S. Army. Just an interesting period of transformation that I hadn't really connected with naturalism.
Yeah, well, I mean, when the railroads come, what follows is, you know, a systematic destruction of, you know, a natural, you know, wild lands. I mean, it just has to be. And Roosevelt saw that happen, saw how that happened in North America with the four main lines heading west. And, you know, all of these railroads were scouted out by railroad expeditions. They were looking for the best route to get from east to west, and teams of naturalists from the Smithsonian would go out and they would join these surveying parties and they would, you know, study the fauna, you know, out there before the trains came in. But the interesting thing about the railroads is, and Roosevelt caught it almost just right on the Northern Pacific Railroad, is as very quickly after they're put in, you just begin to see the towns coming up, the villages, the towns, and the hunting and all of that. He was there on one of the first waves. In fact, the railroad was still being built when he made his first trip out west. And so he was getting there right in time, you know, just as the area was accessible, but still not spoiled.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the phones. We have David joining us from Exeter. David, welcome to The Exchange.
Well, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to make a couple of points here. First of all, I am a descendant of William Wingate Sewall, who was one of Theodore Roosevelt's mentors and guides up in northern Maine in Aroostook County there on Mattawamkeag Lake. And I have spent many summers up there and heard many stories about Mr. Sewall's association with Theodore Roosevelt. And also when they went out to the Dakotas, to the Elkhorn Ranch, where they were with Theodore Roosevelt for a time. And I just wanted to ask your guest if he knew of a book that Mr. Sewall, William Wingate Sewall, wrote about Theodore Roosevelt. It's called Bill Sewall's Story of T.R., and I wanted to see if your guest knew of that resource.
Sure. Thanks, David. Darren?
I do, and I have the book. And thanks for giving the full name of William Wingate Sewall. I was struggling earlier to recall the middle name. I do have that book, and one of the pleasures of writing this book is I'm a bibliophile, and I got to literally buy hundreds of books. It was a great excuse to just click that button and order things that I wanted. But, yeah, that's in my collection, and it's a good one.
You can call into the exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email us, exchange at nhpr.org. We're talking today with Darren Lundy, the author of a new book on Theodore Roosevelt as a naturalist. And Darren, maybe you could say a little bit more about the example of Yellowstone. I found this really interesting. You know, nowadays you mainly have Park Service guides telling people not to stand too close to the bison for selfies. But Roosevelt saw something very different out there.
Yeah, I mean, he saw a lot of poaching out there. I mean, he saw a land that was, you know, the park had been created, but there weren't any laws in place to really protect it. And, you know, everyone knew it was wrong and everyone knew it was, you know, unsustainable. But really what you had is you had a commercialization or thanks to Roosevelt, you know, it's not commercialized. It would have been, you know, totally transformed into hotels and and restaurants. That's the Yellowstone Park Commission was, you know, kind of this. It just had a very different vision for what that park should be than what we have now. And it was Roosevelt working with the Boone and Crockett Club, which he founded with George Bird Grinnell, that one of their greatest accomplishments was lobbying Congress and getting the protections that were needed in Yellowstone. I mean, you know, Roosevelt has this reputation, you know, I think unfairly, of being this bloodthirsty hunter. I mean, well, he knew what hunting was all about, and he knew what was, you know, ethical hunting, and he had a very strong ethical sense, and he knew what was wrong, and he fought hard to vehemently just fought to end this kind of commercial, what's called meat hunting. Most of the hunting that was going on was to supply these hotels that were being built with fresh game for their restaurants.
Can you say a little bit more about the origins of the Boone and Crockett Club? I thought that was really interesting as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's George Bird Grinnell, again, you know, founder of the Audubon Society, who also, you know, convinced Roosevelt and didn't convince Roosevelt. It was really Roosevelt's idea. He wanted to found something similar for mammals, for big mammals. And he wanted to have a society that would teach hunters, you know, proper ethics. I mean, he wanted it to be a lot of things, but he wanted it to be a group of influential men that, and it was all men back then, who would get together and, you know, rally for what they felt was their proper brand of hunting, this ethical hunting, hunting that was based on science and based on, you know, not shooting things in the breeding season and not taking more than is sustainable. I mean, that's what the Boone and Crockett Club was and is about.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, the sort of the issue of wealth and to the extent that it played into these kinds of organizations. You know, Roosevelt was in a position where he could go off on a hunting trip for, you know, 5 or 6 weeks and sort of, you know, fund guides and supplies, et cetera. I mean, that really is there is that aspect of this when you talk about these groups in New York, right?
Sure. I mean, it costs money to do these things, and we can't all do it on that scale, and it is something of a privilege, I guess, to be able to make like an annual 5-week trip like Roosevelt did. But yeah, I mean, it's a group. I mean, I'm not – membership to the Boone and Crockett is restricted to 100 members. So, and
so
I'm,
it's still
I'm
active.
Not one of them. So it's not
–
oh, sure. They're still active. Yeah, yeah.
Very interesting. Well, we still have some more to talk about, but we got to take one more quick break. More coming up on Theodore Roosevelt's legacy as a hunter naturalist. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Today, Theodore Roosevelt's legacy as a hunter naturalist. Call in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email at exchange@nhpr.org. You can also find us on Facebook or Twitter. My guest is Darren Lundy. He's Supervisory Museum Specialist at the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History. He's author of a new book on Theodore Roosevelt, The Naturalist. And Darren, I want to talk a little bit more. You were touching on something that I was interested in exploring, this sort of reconciliation of hunting with naturalism. But a little more specifically, I'm interested in Teddy Roosevelt's notion of what the scientific enterprise should be. You have this great scene in the book where, and I think it's just like 4 years before he becomes the president, he's literally having a formal public debate with another naturalist over how to divine species and subspecies, and sort of really invested in defining science, which is something I think people just don't really know about him.
Yeah, I mean, he was in regular communication with the principal mammalogists of his day, you know, the people that whose job it was to study mammals and describe new species. And one of the debates that, you know, will never be resolved is just what constitutes a species exactly. You know, where do you draw the boundaries around what that concept is? And, it was a spirited debate. And I think Roosevelt, had perfectly valid points that have stood the test of time, that you could look at any group and you could, you know, divide it into lots of small. Famously, he had this line that he could, you know, look at all of the different foxes on Long Island and come up with 50 some odd species based on natural variation in their coloration. And so, you know, he was aware of the main scientific questions of his day and was conversant in them and can debate scientists.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about his time as president. As we know, he becomes president as a result of an assassination. From reading your book, you almost get the sense that that Roosevelt was a little bit irritated with being president because it cramped his style in terms of being able to hunt.
Yeah, I mean, he, you know, there's the famous teddy bear hunt, you know, on the Sunflower River, where, you know, he got into a situation where I don't really cover it in the book because it's not part of the story that I want to tell, but it's the press followed him and they were looking for any slight misstep and were trying to, and he just said, "This is terrible. I can't do anything now. I've got to wait." And probably that's part of the reason why he did what he did when he got out is went on this big scientific expedition, you know. And one of his rules was he didn't want the press following him in Africa.
And that's where the name Teddy Bear comes from? I've heard that before.
Yeah, that's where the name Teddy Bear comes from. I mean, it's a well-known story. It's the story of when, you know, he was hunting, black bear down south in the cane breaks. And, they were hunting with dogs and they cornered a bear. And, you know, there's an ethical way that he felt that should be done and an unethical way. And Teddy just refused to be a part of anything unethical, and that's where the teddy bear phenomena came from.
Yeah, it seems like he almost had this kind of reverence or this notion of it needed to be a fair encounter with the wildlife. So let's talk a little bit about his time in office in terms of conservation. You mentioned in the book that he actually initially doesn't focus all that much on conservation, but just kind of looking at the breadth of his time in office, some of the sort of the high points in terms of what he moved forward on conservation.
Well, I mean, you know, Roosevelt really defined and ushered in the entire sort of conservation movement and the conservation ethic. I mean, you could pick up any book on Roosevelt and you could read about, you know, the specific national parks and protected areas that he created. And I think that's an important part of his legacy, and I've been criticized about this somewhat. But I specifically, in my book, I wanted to talk about a side of him that I think most people don't really it's very easy to jump to his conservation accomplishments and his achievements, as great as they are. But I think there's a deeper story here. These accomplishments, they don't come from nothing. They come from someone who, as part of their soul, as part of who they are, they're a naturalist. And I think, you know, since he was a tiny little boy, Roosevelt was a naturalist, and that defines his persona. And I think understanding exactly the roots of that are important to understanding his specific accomplishments and legacies.
Mm-hmm. You make an interesting distinction in the book, and it's something that had never occurred to me before, the difference between a conservationist and a preservationist. I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, it's a preservationist is someone that wants to, I guess John Muir would be a good example, just leave it be, don't touch it, don't change it, don't. A conservationist is essentially wise use. It's like, look, we're here. We're going to interact with nature. We're a part of it. Let's be smart about it. Let's cut timber when we need to, but let's do it in a way that's sustainable. And it was a big debate in Roosevelt's time. I mean, conservation versus preservationists were very. It was a very strong movement mm-hmm. in his time.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the famous Smithsonian African expedition and your discussion earlier with a caller. You mentioned how this is, and you've also just suggested that he kind of had this sort of pent up energy to do a big hunting trip. Just say a little bit about that expedition. I mean, it seems pretty remarkable in its scope for that time.
Yeah, it was a big expedition, even for its time. I mean, they were there just under a year. Hundreds of people, traveling through Kenya, camping, traveling, moving, shooting, collecting, preserving Kenya, Uganda, and up through Sudan, collecting hundreds of, big game animals, which they preserved and described, dozens of new species and accumulated a collection that they collected birds, they collected mammals, they collected fossils, these fossil snails, people don't know about that. They collected fish, plants. It was a real zoological expedition that to this day remains the most important record of the natural history that is in East Africa. I mean, people don't realize that, everything that was named, every species that's named, every distribution of an animal that's known, you pick up any field guide to any animal or to any region, everything in there is based on people going out and collecting these species. Now, you don't need to, collect a lion, to prove that it's a lion, but for the vast majority of species, the distinctions between them are quite subtle and not necessarily obvious, and you need to build these big collections of specimens to kind of have that big picture perspective that you could always go back to and refer to. Every specimen that's collected, we know exactly where it came from, when it was there, and we could look at its morphology and continually reassess what we think it is.
Yeah, it's interesting. You mentioned that he was, as a naturalist, he was not only interested in, bagging the biggest trophy, but literally having some of these species at sort of every major stage in their lives as to have a full record of it.
Yeah, I think even more so, he was interested in the scientific side. He admitted that he and Kermit wanted to take a few trophies to hang back at Sagamore Hill in Oyster Bay. But he specifically, he wanted to get good representative collections of the fauna. I mean, he wanted to get, they spent weeks and months, and collected great amounts of energy collecting mice. That's nobody's trophy. But he did that for science.
I have not been to Africa, but it sounds like you have traveled around that part of the world pretty extensively. Does this Africa that he encountered, does it just no longer exist or only exist in nature preserves? What would it be like for somebody retracing his steps now?
I think it'd be a dramatically transformed, landscape for the most part. I mean, there are certain areas in protected areas. I mean, the protected area is a protected area. It maintains, more or less. But even in protected areas, the composition of the fauna has changed. You don't have quite as many, large mammals as you did in the past. And then that changes, what you experience when you go there. But I think the vast majority of, it's just what happens in, it's the same thing that happened in the American West. When the railroads went west, civilization followed and the landscape was transformed. And, you set aside protected areas where you could, maintain some vestige of what was once spread out across the whole landscape. But Roosevelt saw that out west and he knew that was going to happen inevitably in East Africa, and you know, was even pushing his European hunting fraternity colleagues into, you know, doing something like a Boone and Crockett Club and, you know, hey, let's start putting some reserves aside here in East Africa.
Yeah, and it's interesting, although there were clearly people who were critical of his trip, from what you describe, it sounds like when he returned, he was treated as kind of a conquering hero. You describe thousands of people meeting him at the harbor when he came back into New York City.
Right. Well, Roosevelt was the most popular man in the world. Everyone knew him. He was just so incredibly popular. He was greeted as a hero because he was Theodore Roosevelt.
Sort of getting close to running out of time here, and I want to kind of take a step back and talk a little bit about today. There's an interesting kind of message throughout your book from Roosevelt's time, but also more currently, this idea that people are increasingly removed from nature, and we all know with the digital technology and smartphones and iPads and all that kind of stuff, video games, it's real easy to just kind of stay inside, and that people mm-hmm. are almost kind of in some sense afraid of nature now. Say a little bit about that, and is that really a big problem, and if so, how do you turn that around?
I think it can be a big problem. I think it's something that I touch on throughout the book. It's a major theme of mine, and it's probably going to be the subject of a follow-up book, just the different ways in which people interact with nature based on where they're coming from, both, you know, what time period they're coming from, whether it was 100 years ago or today, or what their life experiences are. And I think, yeah, we are growing increasingly distant from nature. Roosevelt recognized this 100 years ago. I mean, that's why he was, you know, so adamant about, you know, describing his hunts in such detail, because he knew people wouldn't be doing this. People wouldn't have this contact. They wouldn't have this sort of hands-on, visceral. We observe nature through telephoto lenses, you know, and if we have an ethic, it's don't disturb it, you know, don't touch it. And I think it's a problem when it gets to an extreme, and when you lose it, when nature becomes something other in your mind, it becomes something other than what it is. You know, if you become that far removed from it, I mean, nature, Roosevelt has these great quotes where he's like, you know, death by cold, death by starvation. These are the usual ends of, you know, the beautiful creatures, I'm paraphrasing, but the beautiful creatures in the wilderness. And he understood that there was a danger in thinking that nature was like, you know, like Disneyland, like, you know, like some idyllic place. He understood it to be, you know, tooth and claw. Mm-hmm.
What do you see as the future of natural history museums? You talk a little bit in the book about the transformation in terms of the ability to display animals in their natural habitats and make them more interactive. You know, kind of give us a sense in the time remaining what the discussion is among professionals like yourself about where museums should head and maybe how they make use of technology.
Well, that's a big subject, but museums change. Museums have to change. They always have to change. And I think the direction that they're going in is the direction we need to go in, which is, you know, education and outreach and, you know, just being the places where all of this information on the natural world is brought together and, you know, collated and assimilated and interpreted and presented to the public, you know, so that people can see and understand where we're at right now in the world. I think, you know, I mean, you mentioned technology. I mean, sure. I mean, you know, back in Roosevelt's day, it was the diorama, and right. Dioramas are beautiful. You go in a museum, and I love dioramas, but that is being supplanted, you know, by, you know, technology today. People don't need to look at a glass box to imagine, you know, what nature was like or is like.
Yeah, perhaps we'll have digital holograms of animals rather than seeing the taxidermied ones. But it sounds like that's also not only a part of the legacy of this natural history work, but still useful to you as a scientist and also as part of a museum.
Sure.
So what do you have coming up next for you? We only have about a minute and a half or so left, but I'd like to give a sense of kind of where do you see your enterprise heading? I mean, this is kind of a sort of an addition to your regular work at the Smithsonian, mm-hmm. yet it seems like it's something that you, just from this hour that we spent together, are kind mm-hmm. of deeply connected to.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a museum guy. I've my whole life I've worked for natural history museums, you know, 20 years at the American Museum, 6 years at the Smithsonian, before that my own museums and at the Cornell Museum, and you know, that's my whole life. But really my enterprise, you know, I wrote this book about Roosevelt because I thought he brought an interesting perspective. Here was someone who interacted with nature in a way that I could understand and relate to. But I've gotten more and more interested, like I said, in the different ways in which people interact and relate to nature. And I think that's the direction I'm going to go in, is further explore how, depending on where you're coming from, how you see the world differently with regards to nature.
Are there any other kind of key public figures or national or international figures who you think would benefit from this kind of a reconsideration? Anybody pop to mind that you'd like to explore?
I've had a lot of politicians contact me, which was really surprising.
That's
me.
That's interesting.
I had a lot of politicians contact me that were intrigued by what I had to say in the book, and that took me aback. But, yeah, if I could, you know, get a conversation going on, you know, let's look at the different ways that people relate to, interact with, understand. Some people, the only way they understand with nature is by fearing it. And I think that's a problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, we are out of time. I'd like to thank my guest for a really interesting and enjoyable conversation. Darren, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
That's Darren Lundy. He's a supervisory museum specialist in the Division of Mammals at the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History. Darren's new book is The Naturalist, Theodore Roosevelt, A Life of Exploration and the Triumph of American Natural History. And remember, the conversation always continues online, on Facebook, and at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Faith Meixel and Jessica Hunt. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Sam Ruthier. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoy.